Mr. Watkins, Reel 6. Now, before we go on, it might be nice to look at some of your officers who were in charge. What about, the captain was...
The captain was only about 28 years old, I think, Lieutenant Brownrie. A typical neighbour, so very tall, round-faced, chubby cheeks. A typical English boy, really. And... I'm sure it was his first command. And he used to make me a bit nervous because when we went into action, he'd always be a little bit dubious about the deployment of the other ships. And he'd very often leave the bridge and go down to the plot, which was down a little stairway, underneath him. And he'd be prone to dash down there to look at the radar and look at the plot to be sure of where we were. And that didn't really make you feel very, safe that he had to do that. Our second captain, Mr. Goatley, he would always stay on the bridge. And he seemed to have it well in his grasp, in his memory, to know the deployment of the other ships around him.
We'll come back, because you got him quite a bit later,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah. Well, the other officers were... Lieutenant Vaughan.
What was his job?
RN. The captain was RN. Lieutenant Vaughan was RN. He was very good. Very.
What was his job?
Well, he was the first lieutenant, and he was very good on discipline and very forthright. I liked him a lot. And he ran the ship, really, the first lieutenant. He made sure everything worked. The other officers. Well, there was the tall Mr. Raymond Corey, who was one of the family of the Corey shipping firm. He was a very well-spoken and likable chap.
A lieutenant?
Lieutenant. He was only a sub-lieutenant when we joined then. He got made up to lieutenant later.
What was his job?
I think he was in charge of the forecastle when we left the harbour or went into the harbour or anything. And he was always on the forecastle doing with the anchors and cables and things like that. And he'd rather make me laugh occasionally because he'd never lose his cool, and the captain often would. He'd yell over the bridge, do this, do that, what do you think you're doing, and all that sort of thing, if something went wrong, as it often did. And he'd never lose his call. He'd always answer the captain in a very refined voice. And it was rather funny for us to hear there's an exchange going on. The navigator, Mr. Begg, he was a Scottish lad. He was a very efficient navigator.
You were his yeoman at times. What was he like?
He was very good. He was very good. Once he got used to his accent, but he was very... A Scottish accent when it's a little bit educated, I think it's a very clear, concise speech. But, he was very good. I liked him. He's a big... There's Mr. Wardle. I didn't know him all that well. I think he was probably in charge of the quarterdeck.
Him and Begg were both sub-lieutenants,
yes,
were
they? Yes. There was only... The only other lieutenant we had on board was Mr. Frank Maddox, who was RNVR. And he was an artistic type who, after the war, became manager of the Theatre Royal in Bath. But he was a very good artist and used to draw caricatures of the more... outgoing members of the ship's company and stick them on the notice board. That's where everyone's amusement.
Now, you've got a couple of stories about him. I'll just pick them up. One is when he was leaving Portsmouth. The ship was leaving Portsmouth and his attempt to signal to some wrens. Can I tell that story?
Well, it was when we were coming back off patrol going into Portsmouth. And our route then was past the Mad Tower and past one of the old forts going into Portsmouth Harbour. And we'd sail parallel to the coast for a mile or so along the front of South Sea. And right at the end of South Sea front was this old fort-like building, which was a rennery. And invariably, we used to be on the aqueduct coming in and all in our felling and all this. But Mr. Barrett obviously fancied his chance to be one of the reins, and he had his binoculars trained on the reins that were giving us away. And he suddenly decided to go at the back of the bridge and pull the lanyard that worked the ship's siren, which he did with rather too much gusto, and the lanyard broke, and the ship's siren was subsequently going for about 20 minutes as we sailed into Portsmouth Harbour with our siren going all the time. That caused rather a lot of amusement among the crew as well. Yeah, it was going until somebody shinned up the mast with a hammer and hit the leaf, popped it off. But the other occasion was near the end of the war, when it must have been as near as Christmas 1944, when we were coming back off patrol. We'd been out for 3 days and had no sleep. And Mr. Maddox had a bit of sleep when the action finished about 4:30 in the morning. And the rest of us were on watch, having no sleep, and he'd had a couple of hours sleep, so he came onto the bridge, reasonably fresh, and he greeted me with a good morning, and I said good morning in return, and he started looking back through his binoculars at the upper deck of the ship, and didn't see any sign of life. And he made a remark to me about it, and I remember saying, well, the lad had had no sleep for 3 days, they're all in need of a good night's rest. And he still didn't fancy it very much. He had another look aft and said, I can't see any sign of life aft, Watkins. He said, for exercise, fire pattern one. And I couldn't believe him. I said, are you really serious, Mr. Barrett? Layers are rather tired, you know. He said, no, that's, I mean it. He says, pass the order, for exercise, fire pattern one. So I accidentally, on purpose, stepped back on the cease fire button to make a noise, and he gave me a dirty look, but he let it pass, and I passed the order, and I repeated about 6 times, for exercise, and then fire pattern one, and obviously what had happened was the petty officer in charge of the depth charges had heard the ceasefire bell, and given the ordinary seaman on the headphones a shake, and unfortunately the lad had come through just in time to hear me say fire pattern one, which he repeated in a loud voice, and so the depth charge crews fired pattern one, and we were going nowhere near as fast as we should have been. So 4 depth charges were fired, and they were only set about 50 feet. And when they went off, there was a huge mountain of water came up, and the stern of the ship practically came out of the water. At which the captain came running up on the bridge, and Mr. Maddox went rather white, red, and all sorts of other colours. And, well, when the captain got there, immediately said, slow ahead together, and we virtually stopped. And there was a short inquest between the captain and Mr. Maddox. And when we did start trying to get underway again, there was an ominous thumping in the rear of the ship. And we carried on, managed to make it back to Sheerness, doing about 4 or 5 knots, that was all, with the thumping going on to the stern of the ship all the time. And when we eventually got into Sheerness, we went straight into dry dock and discovered that we'd broken one of the supporting pieces of steel that supported the propeller shaft. And the propeller shaft was wobbling rather violently, and that was the cause of it. So we stayed in the dry dock, and it must have been about Christmas 44, because I can remember the captain was so incensed that what had happened, that he'd cancelled all leave and made the ship's company paint ship in dry dock, which was quite hairy, because we had to throw landing painting stages over the side and paint from the upper deck down to the waterline, and then lower ourselves another 60 feet to the bottom of the dock, go around to the gangway and come around and start again from the top.
Now, it's quite a thing. I mean, I noticed in your letter there's quite a thing about painting chip. You were quite.
Well, I've never heard of it being done in dry dock before. I'm sure you had to get special permission for that. But it was quite hairy. If anybody had fallen off a stage, they'd have come a cropper. We had to have safety lines around our waist all the time, tied through, and there was a rating on the upper deck, tying a rope, you know, so if you did slip, you would only dangle and not fall to the bottom of the dock.
But it seems that Lieutenant Vaughan, the first lieutenant, seemed to have quite a lot of desire to keep the ship looking through. You mentioned that everyone was disgusted with the appearance of HMS Stainer compared to the Retterling.
Well, we were quite proud of the fact that our ship, mind you, it meant a lot of work. The lads used to have to get the paint pots out every time we had a spare day in harbour. But, Stainer was invariably covered with daubs of red lead and paint flaking off, and it didn't look very good at all. But, well, I think that went through the ship's company, and I was pleased enough then to be on the Retallick, which wasn't quite a smart ship. It was on two or three occasions. We were sent out on patrol when other ships, at the last minute, reported that they had engine trouble and couldn't go out. So on three or four occasions, we were sent out in place of another ship. And on one occasion, we'd already sent our Liberty men ashore. So to make up the ship's company, we had to take on ratings from Stainer and one of the other ships as well to make up the guns crews and everything. And they did look rather a scruffy lot when they came aboard. But we managed our patrol all right and everything worked out all right.
Was it a happy ship? Do you know what I mean by a happy ship? If you could just explain it as well.
I think it was. And I think that was mainly down to genial officers. Well, strong officers in the upper regions, the captain and the first lieutenant were very good, and they kept a sharp and happy ship. A happy ship is a clean and well-run ship, and I think that's what they did for us.
What about some of the petty officers, leading seamen, things like that? Any particular ones that you came in contact with or remember?
Well, I can remember leading seaman Clark was in charge of the forecastle, I believe, at that time. He was pretty strict in the discipline as well. He didn't let any of the lads spy or neglect their duty in any way. Can't remember the names of many.
What were they like, most of them then?
It was hard working. Once we were based at Portsmouth.
No, sir. What did you think of the leading seaman, the petty officer? As a group, treat you?
Oh, very well. They treated you with a certain amount of respect. They yelled at you when you had to do work, of course, on wires and anchors and cables and things like that. But yes, everything worked pretty smoothly.
Were they competent?
Yes, I think they were. I think they were. We had one or two awkward occasions later on when we were based at Harwich, when we had the oil ship take on diesel, and the oilers there were usually tied up fore and aft. And if you try and go along a ship that's riding at anchor, that's fair enough, because the tide's taking you, you can just go alongside it. But if it's tied up fore and aft to a buoy, the tide is very often pulling you away from the ship if you're on one side, or pushing you hard onto the ship if you're on the other side. And sometimes it's very difficult indeed to manoeuvre a ship alongside an oiler if it's tied up fore and aft, because you're fighting the wind and the tide to try and get the ship alongside, and you've got to get the heaving lines over very, very quickly to get a stronger line to hold the ship so that you can just put it around the capstan and pull your ship in towards the side of the oiler so you can get the big oil pipe feeds aboard.
Now, what about the actual D-Day operations? What do you remember of Retallick's involvement in that?
Well, I can remember being at Portsmouth and seeing a huge armada of troop ships and Royal Naval ships. Of course, the Solent and the Spithead were absolutely packed. Every boy had every boy had a ship on it, but mostly the others were all at anchor. But yes, it was just a mass. I can close my eyes now and see the mass of ships. One huge one that was obviously a nice big troop ship called the Battle Axe. Probably that was just its name for the day, I don't know, but it had a big sign on saying Battle Axe. And we left them and we went across and we were patrolling off the coast of Normandy for, I believe, a couple of days before the Armada arrived. So it must have been probably June the 4th we left Portsmouth and started patrolling. And then the great day arrived and we found ourselves in the middle of, I believe it was Rodney, Lord Roberts, and the Warspite. We were mainly in that area.
And what were you actually doing?
Well, we were trolling up and down, mainly in case of e-boat attacks, but fortunately there weren't any. And I don't know, we were just patrolling up and down.
Could you see the effects of the battleships?
Yeah, at some time they were firing over our heads. We were partly escorting some of the tank landing craft into the shore. And they were firing, the big ships were firing over our heads. You could hear the whistle of the shells as they went overhead. And you could see the results as well, because we were close enough to the shore to see the explosions of the shells when they landed. But, well, time passed. I suppose we must have had some sleep that night at some time. But we were off on patrol again the next day. And things went on, you know. There were lots and lots of aircraft, I remember that. There was almost no opposition aircraft there. They were all British and American aeroplanes. I remember some weeks probably after D-Day, they did a 1,000 bomber raid, and the Lancasters and Flying Fortresses were going over all day long. It was incredible. And we were close enough inshore to see some of them shot down. You could see the poor lads coming down. And as they flew over, as they came back, usually they'd be dropping the recognition flares. Each day there was a different sequence of coloured flares that the aircraft used to drop to make sure that our own ships didn't fire upon them, thinking they were enemy planes. So the colour code of the day was always passed around to the guns each day so that we wouldn't fire on any of our own aircraft. But Spitfires and that, they used to go across in pairs. They were always buzzing around the sky. Spitfires and Hurricanes zooming about the sky all the time. And the time went past, and within 2 weeks, I recall, we had a terrible storm, and an awful lot of the Mulberry Harbour was washed away. It broke from its moorings, and we had a signal to go out and sink them because they were a danger to shipping. There were huge, big pontoons of airtight tanks floating around in the channel, and we spent 2 or 3 days going around sinking them with our 3-inch guns. But it took, you know, several shells, probably half a dozen shells in each one to sink them, because they were very, very airtight. They must have been all separated, lots of little airtight pockets in them. But I remember we had a blackboard on the bridge, and one of the officers was marking them off in groups of 5, and we sank over 80, so we did quite well. And what else could I remember?
You're still at Portsmouth during this period?
Well, we're based at Portsmouth, yes, for a long time. Yes, we come back every now and again to replenish supplies, or we used to go alongside used to get supplies from the battleships occasionally. If we were short of potatoes, we would send a boat over and replenish basic supplies from the battleships, which seemed to have plenty on board. And then about not very many weeks after D-Day, the armies had got a good hold on the beachhead by then, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think, I was on middle watch, and we were on our patrol line, and we had a signal to go to the rest of the assistance of a Liberty boat that was full of American soldiers going over to the beachhead. I don't know whether it was mined or torpedoed, but it was on fire when we reached it. It took us about half an hour to reach the ship in mid-channel. And we approached it as near as we could, but there was explosions coming from it. It was obviously full of ammunition, and it was on fire amidships. And there was just the stern and the bow, which had groups of American soldiers on it. And an awful lot of them had jumped in the sea. And unfortunately, they hadn't had proper training in the use of their own life belts, which were self-inflating. And an awful lot of the lads would put them on like belts around their waists. And when they jumped in the sea, their backs were out of water, but their heads and their feet were under water, which was rather horrific. There were dozens of them like that. And we lowered our boat and went in as close as we dare, and we picked up survivors and stayed on the rescue job for probably 3 hours. And there was another ship with us, the Beagle. There was another destroyer there anyway. And we packed the ship with as many survivors as we could.
What state were they in when you got them out?
They were pretty weak. They were pretty weak. We had scrambling nets over the side, and we were, a lot of the lads were over the side helping them out of the water. They hadn't got the strength to crawl out of the water. So we hung on to them until somebody went down with a rope and put down the middle, and we hoisted them up the side and on board. One or two of them, we didn't have a doctor on board, but there was a sick berth attendant. And some of the crew were trying to resuscitate some of them that were unconscious. We had success with some, and others we didn't. But we took them all back to Portsmouth, and it was a memory that stayed with me a long, long time, because I'd never seen, you know, so many wasted lives in that situation. And I was a bit horrified. Much later, only a few years ago, when I saw a video film of the practice for D-Day, when American ships were supposed to land troops on the coast of Dorset, and one of the survivors of the American ships had got sunk because the U-boats had attacked them, and he actually said that he'd seen American soldiers drowning with these life belts around their middles in exactly the same way that I'd seen them, and that was about 6 weeks later. And it seemed appalling to me that the message hadn't been learned and more instruction given as to the correct use of these American life belts. I only wore my British one, which was very, very simple but very effective. You just blew into a sausage of air across your chest and that was it. But it was rather appalling. It was rather appalling to see all these lads' lives wasted in vain.
Now, what about the watch system on the Retalick? I mean, you weren't actually on long trips usually, were you?
No, it was usually about 3 days out and 1 day back. And mainly the 1 day back was sleeping, so that you'd replenish your batteries.
So how did the watch system operate?
Well, there were three types. There were action stations when everybody was on the action station, of course.
And that was your bridge comms guns.
Defence stations, only half the crew were closed up. So I had an opposite number that did my job on the bridge at the defence station. And cruising stations, we didn't often do that. But that was three watches. The ship's company was split into three watches. and so you're now the third of the ship's company on duty, and the others are either working or doing whatever, sleeping, hopefully. But, yeah, some of the cruising stations time, I used to take do a watch on the radar machine, which I found fascinating. You would switch it from 5 miles to 10 miles to, no, 5, 15 and 25 on the three ranges. And if you switched to 25 miles, you could actually see the coast of Britain and the coast of France on the screen. But mainly...
you hadn't been trained in it, you were just...
No, I doing it. Now, I think we had one chap that had been trained in it, but it's very new. It was very new, radar, you know. We all wondered what it was when we first joined the ship and saw this big circular pod on the top of the mast, and somebody said it was radar, and we didn't realise what it was doing until we had a chance to look at the radar set in the side of the wheelhouse.
Could you tell what was going on without your training? Because there's quite a lot of training for radar they normally have, but...
Yeah, well, it was mainly to... I was only doing cruising stations, I mean, I wasn't really looking for anything particular. It was just to have somebody on the set, I think, in case of emergency. But mainly our settings were on the 5 mile to look for any e-boats or small boats. You just got a small blip come up on the screen. But nothing ever happened when I was on duty, fortunately.
Did you get nervous? I mean, you were going out quite a lot, one day in, 3 days out.
Yeah.
How was your morale, as they call it? How nervous did you get?
The morale was not bad. Well, we were a lucky ship, I think. I can look back and say that, because when you look at the statistics in Donald Collins' book, I think 17 out of 78 ships were sunk by the end of the war. So, I think we were lucky that...
And how about yourself? Did you get nervous, or how did you cope in yourself?
I don't think you've got time to be nervous. In action, everything's going on, and there's orders being yelled, and you're just there. And looking back on it, you can't really... It would have been very hard to have written a description of the action afterwards, because it was sort of 20 minutes or half an hour of turmoil, and you were just very, very pleased when it all finished.
What about between actions? Did you sort of dread the next one, you know, when you did have time, you know?
I don't that dread. I think apprehension is more the word to fit. You were apprehensive. I don't think any of us were gung-ho enough to want to look forward to it and wish that another one would happen. you were apprehensive. But you just did your job. You were trained to do your job, and mainly we did it. Where were we?
Now, what about when you were in port? Did you ever get the chance to get out for a night out?
Occasionally in Portsmouth, yes. Yes, we'd be tied up to a buoy off of Ryde Pier on the Isle of Wight. And
that's where you actually were, was it? Because that's that opposite Portsmouth.
That's opposite Portsmouth, yeah.
And that was where you were anchored?
We were anchored there all the time. We were on patrol. We didn't go into the dockyard unless we were, well, perhaps due for a couple of days rest off the patrol line. When we were on the patrol line, we were just tied up in a buoy, and the Liberty boat used to run the lads ashore from the buoy of the Isle of Wight, right across into Portsmouth Harbour. I drove it once or twice. I can still remember the route we used to have to take. I could probably do it today. Once or twice it was right here because of a thick fog there. I had a few days in a thick fog. And I could remember going to Portsmouth Harbour with my bowman laying on the bow with an oil lamp to shine against the fog bank. And you would try and hope you didn't hit anything. But we didn't get ashore a lot in port. It was the occasional pub visit, but it wasn't a lot.
Did you drink much then, or...?
No, I didn't. I didn't drink the old pint of beer, and that was it.
Did many of the men drink?
Yeah, some of them did. Some of them did. And I can remember taking the Liberty boat back to the ship, and some of them were too drunk to climb up the ladder and had to have a rope tied round their waist and hauled on board. And if any of at that time, quite a lot of the lads were having their birthdays, and if we were due to go out on patrol, the usual routine, if they were too far gone, was to put them in the, we used to call it the spud locker. There was a little wire cage at the side of the ship, and we used to put them in there and turn the hose on them and sober them up in rather double quick time. But no, there wasn't too much drunkenness. It was only occasionally you get the odd chap clubbing your birthday and celebrating a little too strongly.
You wouldn't get